We will continue and complete our rather extensive series on the life of Abraham. This is part 8 of that series, and we now come to the last couple of chapters in the book of Genesis that we'll be looking at. Last time we focused on chapters 22 and 23, and in one regard, I think that was the climax of the story. Everything had been building up to the ultimate trial of faith and trust in God's goodness and power in Abraham's life and Sarah's life, the sacrifice of the son of promise, Isaac. Would Abraham trust God enough after all that he'd been through, all the waiting, and all the final fulfillment of having this miracle baby born? Would he, even though he didn't fully understand it, but by faith, would he trust God enough to actually carry through that ultimate assignment of God, the perfecting, the beautifying of his faith and his trust? And he did. There were some other details that we looked at. But now we come to chapter 24. And I have some introductory comments to say. It's a rather lengthy chapter, actually, chapter 24. I have some introductory thoughts to share with you, and then we will get into it verse by verse. But the way I would introduce chapter 24 of Genesis would be to say that Abraham's faith now has been brought almost to that final point of beauty and perfection. God the potter, Abraham the clay, and forming spiritual character in this man's life. And almost the finishing touches have been put on, on Abraham's faith and trust in God. And it is now stronger and more refined as we enter chapter 24 than ever before in his life. It's been a gradual process. But so we see his faith and his trust in God on display, continuing in chapter 24. But I think we see two other aspects of godly character. In addition to trust and faith, I think we see two other very important parts of godly character in the lives of the first fruits, in the life of Abraham, in the life of those who would be chips off the old block, those who are in Christ or Abraham's seed. And those two additional aspects that I think are prominent in chapter 24 are wisdom. Wisdom is also a gift and a thing that is developed over a long period of time in the lives of the first fruits. The wisdom of God, it is a gift from God. James the Apostle says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God who gives generously. So it's developed. It's a part of the spiritual creation. We see a certain aspect of wisdom that we'll comment on more here in chapter 24. His wisdom, his ability to take different aspects of what he knows about God and put them together. Wisdom is taking facts and information and knowledge, but just properly putting it together. I mean, you can think of like Scrabble letters. You can have all the letters. I mean, everybody playing Scrabble has the same number of letters, don't they? But some people can put these letters together to form words, scoring words. And wisdom is kind of like that. It's able to take knowledge and information and to put it together properly in application. So we're going to see a certain degree of wisdom in what we see Abraham doing here in chapter 24. And then a third thing, we have faith and trust in God. We have wisdom. And then the third thing is the way that he valued the plan of God. He valued the promises of God. You know, the old thing is familiarity breeds contempt. If we've known something maybe for a long time, do we ever let it get old? Do we start to take maybe the things of God for granted, the calling of God for granted, the plan of God for granted? And we see that that is not the case with Abraham. I mean, he's lived a long life now, knowing God and knowing these promises and knowing this plan. But he still highly valued it. He had not let it become a thing of lesser value. It is still at the forefront of his mind, this plan, these promises. These are still very important to Abraham. And so we see that. So we see him trusting God. We see him using the wisdom that is a gift and a development of God, valuing and still having it be very important to him, God's promise and plan. And then acting. All of those three things are not just abstract concepts, but they led him to act and to do something. And the thing that he did primarily is is what we see here in chapter 24. So all of those three parts of character then led to action. Action very unlike what we saw with the Hagar syndrome. Very different. Because now we see him using godly wisdom, him still being very concerned that the plan of God and the promises of God be fulfilled, and his faith in God, but taking action that is in accordance with God's will, not as in the Hagar syndrome, going off track, getting off the track. So we see a better approach here. Now, what am I talking about? Well, here we are late in life. He's shown God his faithfulness and all that. And he's got the plan of God and the promises of God still at the forefront of his mind. Abraham, you are going to be the progenitor of millions, of countless. All right, it's not Ishmael. It's nobody else. It's Isaac. At this point, Isaac doesn't even have one child. And so the promises of God that Abraham would eventually be the progenitor of many, it had to be through Isaac, and Isaac at this time precisely has zero. So using godly wisdom and faith and still having the zeal to see God's purpose worked out, all put together properly, he takes action. He takes action to do what? Get a wife for Isaac. Because if Isaac is going to have at least one child, and he must, if it's to be done in righteousness, he has to have a wife. I mean, Abraham is reasoning correctly now. Plan of God. There have to be others after me. It has to be through Isaac. Isaac has to have at least one child. It has to be, if it's going to be done in righteousness, that Isaac has a wife. And so Abraham puts all that together and he takes action to see to it that Isaac gets a wife. And it's wisdom that it must be the right kind of wife. We see wisdom. And we're going to look at that and some related issues here very much. Now some people, reading the story of Genesis 24, and see that Abraham is insistent that this wife not come from the women of Canaan. And they arrive at the conclusion, well, that's a religious concern. The main thing in Abraham's mind was that Isaac would not take a woman who is an idolater. And I believe that to be an incorrect understanding of what we see. That's not that's unimportant. But that is not the chief or even the main concern. The proof of that is the group of people that he targeted, and he told this servant, you have to go take a wife for Isaac, from that group were themselves idolaters. It was an idolatrous family. So being associated with idolatry, religious purity, I don't want Isaac taking a wife from these people around here because they're idolaters, that was not his chief concern. He had the wisdom of God to have something else be one of his. I'm not saying it was the only one, but one of his chief concerns, and that was compatibility on many levels, and one of them would be ethnic compatibility. We'll see that as we go through the story. Ethnic compatibility. Finding someone from a non-idol-worshipping background cannot have been his only concern. By virtue of the fact that the woman who is chosen from his family back there, herself was from an idolatrous family. Now, I read this verse in Joshua once before, earlier in this series, but for this point, let's go back to Joshua chapter 24. This is an inspired overall summary of the background of this entire family, out of which Abram emerged, and out of which Rebekah, this chosen wife from Isaac, emerges. And there's an overall assessment, there's an overall description of this clan, this family. All right, so it's in Joshua chapter 24. And let's look at the first three verses. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. This is much later, but it's a retrospective, kind of an inspired divine capsule history of these people from whom Abraham emerged, as well as Rebekah. So he gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers. And they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah." Now, he was the father of Abram, or Abraham. He was the father of Abram and Nahor and Haran, these three sons. We read about that way early on. "Your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor." Now, what about the third boy? Well, he died younger. So the focus is on the two sons of Terah who lived longer. He's talking about that clan, that family. "Dwelt on the other side of the river," you know, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley there, on the other side of the Tigris River, "in old times. And what was their background? They served other gods." They were idolaters. God reached down into a family of idolaters. They just didn't have idols. They served them. And then "I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river," and that summarizes bringing him out of Ur of the Chaldees, where he came out of an idolatrous background, an idolatrous family, Terah, his brothers, coming to Haran, stopping over there 5 years. Then when his father dies, he goes on over to Canaan. "I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river," from that kind of a background. What kind of a background? Serving other gods. "And led them throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac." So Abraham now, using godly faith and trust in God, still valuing very much the promises of God, using godly wisdom, this son Isaac has got to have at least one son. If it's to be done in righteousness, he has to have a wife. And so Abraham acts on all that combination of good things and sees to it that Isaac gets a wife, the proper kind of wife. And he wants this wife to be compatible with Isaac along many fronts, but certainly among them would be ethnic compatibility. Not from the other tribal groups around in Canaan, but from back where his own people came from. And so, you know, we could summarize this about Rebekah, the woman who was chosen to be Isaac's wife and to help with Isaac produce the next generation of the promised seed line, Abraham, Isaac. It's going to be Jacob. This Rebekah will be the mother of Jacob. Think about it. Her brother, Laban, was an owner of household idols. He had idols in his own house, chapter 31 of Genesis. So she's coming from a family, and we know her brother owns household idols. This is 31:19 of Genesis. We'll learn a lot more about Laban as we go through, but this is Rebekah's brother. This would be Isaac's brother-in-law. So this is Genesis 31 and verse 19. "Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep." Now Rachel, that's his daughter. This would be Rebekah's niece. Rebekah, this is the next Rachel, the next generation that comes along. Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. So Laban, at this late date, still has household idols. Now some translations say that those are physical objects designating who would be the chief heir. But I don't think that's the adequate explanation, nor do most of the commentaries. These were idols that later on in the story, Jacob says, "Put away all these idols that you worshipped." These are worshipped objects, not just indication of who gets the most inheritance. So this was Laban, the brother of Rebekah, and then Rachel, who would be the niece, and one is stealing household idols from the other. So we summarize about Rebekah, the kind of background she comes from. Her great-grandfather is Terah. We know he worshipped idols. That was what we read in Joshua. So her great-grandfather was Terah. Her great-uncle is Abraham. He came from that same family. Her brother is Laban. He has household idols. Her niece is Rachel, and she stole these idols. So this is a person, Rebekah, who comes from an idolatrous background. So back to the point, when Abraham, with faith and trust in God, using godly wisdom, and still very much concerned that the promises of God be fulfilled the right way, wanting a compatible wife for his son Isaac certainly has ethnic background in mind. This is not solely a religious background. That's why he says not from the Canaanites. It's not because the Canaanites were idolaters and these other people were not. They were too. That's just what we've seen. So it had to at least be among his considerations that there be ethnic compatibility between his son Isaac and this woman who is to be chosen. So he sends his trusted servant in this chapter 24 back to the place of his family roots, trusting that God will intervene and give success to this venture to get a wife for Isaac from his own ethnic background in furtherance of the plan of God. All right, with that as backdrop, let's go to chapter 24. And that's a point of wisdom. Faith, wisdom, and the promises of God still being very important to him. So we'll go to chapter 24. We start with verse 1. Now, Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Eternal had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, "Please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Eternal, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but you shall go to my country and to my kindred," ethnic compatibility, "and take a wife for my son Isaac." This was not simply a matter of religious purity or religious compatibility. There's more to it. So verse 5, the servant said to him, "Yeah, but what if she won't come? Am I supposed to kidnap her? Am I supposed to just force her, kidnap her, and bring her back here? What if she won't willingly come? Maybe I should then, if that happens, maybe I should just take Isaac over there and let him choose his own wife." Abraham said, "Absolutely not. Absolutely not." The wording is, "Perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me back to this land. Must I take your son back to the land from which you came?" But Abraham said to him, "Beware that you do not take my son back there. This is an arranged marriage. Abraham is going to be involved, and he believes God wants it this way. It's not up to Isaac totally to make this decision. That's just the way it is." Abraham says, "No, don't. It's not up to him to make this decision. Certainly not exclusively. Don't take my son back there. You do what I tell you to, and I believe God is going to be in this." And we see that he was in it. "The Eternal God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I give this land,' he will send his angel." Faith, trust in God. He will send his angel. I believe God is going to be doing a miracle or a series of miracles here to see that their desired end is accomplished. "He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there," from that group. And then, to me, almost the most important verse in this whole long chapter is verse 8, the next verse. Is this consistent or inconsistent with trust in God to do his part? Because having made this absolute, dogmatic, faith-filled, trusting statement, he will do this, but if the woman is not willing to follow you, this is from Abraham's lips, not the servant. The servant had a potential objection. This is Abraham. "If she won't come willingly, then you'll be released from this oath. Only do not take my son back there." What we have here is Abraham's acknowledgement, I'm going to use a word here, of contingency. It's an important principle. Contingency. Contingency is defined as a future event or circumstance that is possible, even likely. A future event or circumstance that is possible, even likely. God will give you success. He will send his angel. God will do his part. I believe that, Abraham said. It's a future event or circumstance that is possible, even likely, but cannot be predicted with absolute certainty. Why? Because there are human beings involved. And somebody that God gives a calling to or an opportunity to be a part of his plan can still, as a free moral agent, refuse to get with the program. And God won't force them. He wasn't going to force Rebecca to have her part in this wonderful plan. She didn't have to be the mother of the promised seed. And Abraham acknowledges that. So in verse 8, absolute faith, God will do his part. Verse 8, that was verse 7. But verse 8, Abraham, a man of faith, wisdom, and zeal for the plan of God, acknowledges contingency. Sometimes people, even if given a chance, a wonderful chance, do not comply. And there comes a point where they disqualify themselves. And guess what? That's not going to stop God's accomplishing his will, because he can have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. Now, again, we're going to come back to this, but I think it's an important enough thing. It's right here. I mean, verse 8 is stark on the heels of verse 7. It will happen. It will happen. God will do this. But if she won't come, then okay, you're free of the oath I'm making you take. Abraham is acknowledging when there are human beings involved, they don't have to comply with God's will. They don't have to comply with their calling. They can refuse. But that doesn't negate verse 7. God's will is going to be accomplished. There would have been a plan B. Since it didn't have to be exercised, we don't know what plan B was or plan C. But I want to take you to some other verses in the Bible that really show that this thing of contingency, that there are still free moral agents, and God doesn't force anybody. Now, he's very patient. When he chooses somebody, when he gives them a calling, when he gives them an opportunity to be a part in the fulfillment of his plan, he's very patient with them. I've even used the term stubborn before. I mean, he forgives way more than you or I would as human beings. His mercy endures forever. He's very patient. He's very long-suffering. He forgives and he allows mistakes to be made as long as there's, you know, just progress. But when a person absolutely digs in their heels and will not do their part in God's plan, that's not going to stop God's plan. Somebody else will be given the opportunity. Let's look at a few examples. In the New Testament even, Matthew 3, for example, the notion of contingency. So yes, God's will is going to be accomplished. But no, any one individual can refuse to cooperate till the point where they're no longer a part of it and somebody else. You know, even in the book of Revelation, God said, don't let any man take your crown. Why would he say that unless it was possible that a person could lose their crown? Now, we hope that isn't very many people. You know, we can speculate that it's not and all of that. But anyway, let's look at Matthew 3 and verse 9. Now, this is John the Baptist. And some words needed to be said. It was according to the will of God that some words would need to be said. Or that some things would need to happen. Now, there's a group of people who have an opportunity to be the ones saying the words, or to be have an opportunity to be the ones doing whatever needs to be done. It's a calling. It's an involvement in God's plan and purpose. But if they absolutely refuse, there will come a point where they will be shunted aside, and that purpose will still be accomplished, even if it takes stones talking. That's what he's saying here. Verse 9 of Matthew 3. Do not think to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. These are people that are descendants of Abraham. They have an opportunity to be a part in the playing out of this plan. They got the right DNA. They got the right great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. But I say to you that God is able to raise up children to Abraham from these stones. Luke 19, verse 40. God is going to have seed of Abraham. And that almost sounds like hyperbole. But God is not going to be denied from his plan working out just because some choose not to cooperate. Others will. Somebody can take their place. Luke 19. Now in this case, this is the temporarily triumphant entry of Jesus into Jerusalem in that last week of his life. And it was God's will that his son on the earth be praised at that time. And it was going to happen. Luke 19 and verse 38. So here comes Jesus into Jerusalem, and this crowd, it turned out to be a fickle crowd. We see the words they're saying now, and not that much later they were saying, crucify him. But here are the words that needed to be said. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Eternal. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And I believe that's actually something that was prophesied. Those words needed to be said at that time, and they were going to be said. Well, the Pharisees didn't like it. They could understand that those were words of worship to God, and they didn't want to acknowledge that Jesus was God in the flesh. So they got all upset. Verse 39, some of the Pharisees called to him from the crowd, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. That's blasphemous to say that about you or any other man. Look at Jesus' response. He answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would cry out immediately. Those words needed to be said. And if the people who had the chance to say it weren't going to, God could make stones cry out. Nothing stops God's purpose from being fulfilled. 2 Peter chapter 2. If words need to be said, and people who have a chance to say them won't say them, rocks could be made to say them, or a donkey could be made to say them, and it's happened. Words need to be said. If the prophet is mad, well, let's just read it. The donkey will say the words that need to be said. So here we are, 2 Peter 2 and verse 16. Back to verse 15. They have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, son of Beor. 2 Peter 2:15. Who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but he was rebuked for his iniquity, a dumb donkey, speaking with a man's voice, restrained the madness of the prophet. If a person who has an opportunity to speak the words of God won't, a donkey can. Stones can. The words are going to be said. And then Romans. Of course, this applies back in Genesis. The contingency that even Abraham acknowledged. We'll read it. If the person who was given the opportunity to be a part of the fulfilling of God's plan would refuse, somebody else would have, because God's plan was going to be accomplished. Now here we are in Romans 9, and this Romans 9, 10, and 11 is a three-chapter sequence, the basic theme of which is God's will is going to be accomplished. It's accomplished in ways that human beings often cannot anticipate. God doesn't always do things by the book of humans. He does it by his own book. That's kind of a theme throughout these entire three chapters. Some people have likened it to, you know, like a batter in baseball. He's expecting a fastball. So he makes his swing based on a fastball, and here comes a curveball. Well, sometimes God throws curves instead of fastballs. And where we think we've got figured out, God figured out, sometimes he does something very different because he's God. He doesn't answer to us and our sense of propriety or our expectations. Well, anyway, so here we are in some verses in chapter 9 of Romans. And we'll begin in verse 27. This is Romans 9, 27. Isaiah also cries out concerning Israel. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved. For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will make a short work upon the earth. And as Isaiah said before, unless the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we would have become like Sodom and would have been made like Gomorrah. There were times in Israel's history when it looked like they were cooked. Like not one of them was going to survive. On one or two occasions, God himself was going to wipe them all out. On two occasions, Moses interceded. But if he hadn't interceded, would the whole plan of God have been nullified? No, it wouldn't have. There would have been a plan B. God's purpose, his overall purpose is going to be accomplished. So skip forward to chapter 11. I mean, as I say, that sets up the hypothetical. What if all Israel had been destroyed? Somehow, just like Abraham said, God would have resurrected at least one of them and carried on the line. God has ways to bring his plan about. If he can make rocks talk, And if you make a donkey talk, we don't have to worry about what looks like the end of possibilities, because God has a million possibilities, and he has great power. He has great character, and he has great power. His character is he cannot lie. So if he has said it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And he has great power. He can resurrect people if he needs to. Well, that's what Abraham had worked out when sacrificing Isaac. He had come to that conclusion. But if we go over to chapter 11 of Romans 11, verse 17 of chapter 11:17, we kind of pick up on this. God runs out of Israelites. They won't fulfill his will. Well, guess what? He can use Gentiles. Verse 17 of Romans 11. If some of the branches were broken off, that's natural Israel, and you, speaking to the Gentiles, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them. It's possible to take a dying plant and take a living plant, graft it in, and you have a plant that can carry on. You being a wild olive tree were grafted in. Somebody else, if the first ones don't take advantage of their opportunity, God can find somebody else who will. Became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree. Do not boast against the branches. But if you boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you. The ultimate root of that whole line is Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, much later Christ. The root is still back in Abraham, who was faithful. Well, you will say then, he's putting up possible human reasonings that would contradict. Well, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off. God did allow Israel to cease being a political entity. They were scattered. They went into captivity. It wasn't a nice, straight, clean line, always upward and better, from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, to a nation, to the end. There were devastating setbacks and captivities involved. And God has, in the New Testament, begun to call Gentiles to be a part of this. Maybe not even begun. There was always a mixed multitude, even with ancient Israel. Well, anyway, verse 20, well said, because of unbelief, they were broken off. They didn't cooperate. Well, somebody else, you should stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. But if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. If you're plan B, he could also always come up with a plan C. His will is going to be accomplished. Therefore, consider the goodness and severity of God on those who fail severity, but toward you goodness. And how often should we thank God that he's been as patient and merciful and gracious with us, despite our many failings? If you continue in his goodness, otherwise you also will be cut off. That is always still a possibility, contingency. And they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, well, they're dead. Yeah, but God will resurrect them too. It's called the second resurrection. Ancient Israel will be grafted in, back into where they belonged. For God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more will these who were the natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? So, I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that hardening in part has happened to Israel. And even then, there will be a resurrection in which they will be given God's Spirit and a chance to get it right, until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So to the degree that Israel didn't take advantage of it, Gentiles have. And even then, the resurrected Israelites can be grafted back in. Contingency. And God's will is going to be accomplished. So we go back to Genesis 24. Is this thing that God has led Abraham to do, is it going to be successful? Well, God's going to do his part. And the person that is chosen will be given their opportunity. But it's still possible they'll say no. So let's read the story. I wish you'd never read this before, because I know you already know the end of it. But contingency is there from verse 8. There was a possibility she would have said no. Let's read how this plays out. So we go to verse 9 of Genesis 24. So this servant, and by the way, there's a couple of things here. What about this swearing? I thought Jesus said swear not at all. Well, he did. Abraham wasn't perfect. We've seen him make mistakes before. For whatever reason, this goes uncommented on, but he makes his servant swear that he will be faithful to this assignment. God's original intent, and certainly the New Covenant or the New Testament standard, the gold standard, God's is swear not at all. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. But it is what it is, and it is here. A lot more good in Abraham's life, but the times when it isn't completely in accordance with perfection, they're right there for us to see. Again, we see God's mercy and grace. Well, anyway, verse 9, back to chapter 24. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, and there's all sorts of conjecture about exactly what that means. That is what it is. And his master, and he swore to him concerning this matter, that he would follow the instructions of Abraham. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand. 10 camels. Well, part of the reason, I suppose, would be to take all the dowry gifts. We read about all the gifts that are given to this family if one of their daughters would come back and marry Isaac. And another is, she didn't come back alone. She had her friends, they call her maidens or handmaidens, she had in her retinue, and they needed a ride back so that these ladies would not have to walk. So there were camels for transport, both directions. 10 camels. All right, and departed, for all his master's goods were in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. Well, Nahor is the surviving brother of Abraham. And the city that Nahor lived in is the one that Abraham stopped off in for 5 years, the city of Haran. So that's probably what that means, the city in which Nahor lived, but it's the city of Haran that we saw earlier in the story. This is back to his ancestral home, at least to his halfway point ancestral home. And he made his camels kneel down, the servant did, outside the city by a well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Then he said, O eternal God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day and show kindness to my master Abraham. Be involved in this. Do what I can't do. I've done what I can. I came over here. It's about a 15 or 20 day camel ride. It's a long journey. He's done what he can, but in working out of God's plan, we come to a point we see only God can take the next step. It's beyond our abilities. So he says, show me in a way that I would never figure out myself. And he actually lays out a dialogue in his mind. God, make this dialogue, make this script happen. I'll say certain things. Please make the one you've chosen to say other things in response. Behold, I stand here by the well of water. Verse 13. The daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now let it be that the young woman to whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink, and she says, drink, and I will also give your camels a drink. So both parts of the dialogue, this man says, God, would you please bless this? Now, we don't usually ask God for signs, but on a few occasions, at critical points in the working out of God's purpose, apparently God has honored a request for a sign. Gideon asked for a sign. God wet the fleece and let the ground be dry, and then let the ground be wet and the fleece dry. And God honored that. Not many occasions, but this appears to be asking for a sign. How else would he know which one God has chosen? So he asks for this sign, and God honors it. Let that be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac, and by this sign, I will know that you have shown kindness to my master, that you've revealed the choice. And it happened before he had finished speaking. Look how God is orchestrating this down to the instant. No sooner had this silent prayer been asked, he looks up and here's this woman. Before he'd even finished speaking, that behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor. Apparently Nahor is still alive. He's still the titular head of this family. But by this point, he's very elderly. And his son Laban is going to do most of the talking, most of the negotiating. Nahor has to give his final blessing, but Laban, the son, the brother of Rebekah, does most of the talking. So she comes out with this pitcher on her shoulder, and the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin. No man had known her. And she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me drink a little water from your pitcher." So she said, "Drink, my lord." Just exactly what he had asked God to have her say. Then she hastened and let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels also until they finish drinking." Try to put yourself in this servant of Abraham's sandals. I bet the hair on his neck stood up. Wouldn't you? Do you see something exactly that you've asked to the very words? But there is still contingency. So he's going to be cautious. This is his oldest servant. But age should teach caution. So verse 20. So she hastened and emptied her pitcher into the trough. And she did it several times. So there'd be enough water for all these animals. She ran back to the well to draw water and drew for all his camels. And the man wondering at her. Yes, the hair on his neck had stood up. But he too knew there was still contingency. What if she said no? God's done his part. But will the human instrument cooperate? So he was still wondering. He remained silent so as to know whether the Eternal had made his journey prosperous or not. We still don't have the final answer. So it was when the camels had finished drinking that the man took a golden nose ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels of gold and said, "Whose daughter are you? Tell me, please, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge?" So she said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel." Well, the hairs that weren't already standing up probably now stood up, because now this is the right family. First, the words were correct. Now he's absolutely sure she's from the right family. This is a relative of Abraham and a relative of Isaac. "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor. Moreover," she said to him, "we have both straw and feed enough and room to lodge." Then the man bowed himself his head and worshiped the Eternal. See, God has done his part. That was verse 7. Abraham knew God would do his part. He's brought him into contact with the one God has chosen to have this opportunity. God's not going to fail his part. Well, now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And my suggestion to you is, if you ever meet Laban, don't buy a used car from him. What we learn about Laban is he's fairly tricky. And he always kind of had an angle on things to get an extra buck out of the deal. So you see a lot more about that the next generation when Jacob comes along. But anyway, be careful in dealing with Laban. I'm not saying he's the worst person who ever lived, but maybe test drive that used car before you put your money down. So here comes Laban, the brother, who has been authorized by his father Nahor to do most of this negotiating. He's probably the de facto head of the family by this point. Nahor, we get the sense, is quite elderly. All right, so if I can find my place again. Verse 29, Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And Laban ran out to the man by the well. So it came to pass when he saw the nose ring, what caught Laban's eyes? The money, the dowry, the gold. It came to pass when he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists, and when he heard the words of his sister Rebekah saying, "Thus the man spoke to me," that he went to the man, and there he stood by the camels at the well, and he said, "Come in, O blessed of the Eternal. Why do you stand outside? I have prepared the house and a place for the camels." Well, that's nice. I mean, that's hospitable. We can't really fault him for that. But you always wonder with Laban what he's really thinking. We know what he's saying, but what's he really thinking? So verse 32, then the man came to the house, and he unloaded the camels and provided straw and feed for the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. That's all good. And food was set before him. Let's have a meal. That's good. But at this point, Abraham's servant said, no, there's something so important. We got to get this settled before we relax. This is my mission. And I've got to find out the final step, this contingency. Is she going to come back with us or not? It takes a while to get the final answer. I will not eat until I have told you about my errand. So he said, well, speak on. And he said, I'm Abraham's servant. There's going to be a long second recounting of everything we've already read. The Eternal has blessed my master greatly, and he has become great. Translate, rich. And he has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold, male and female servants and camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old. So we've had a miracle baby born into this family. And to him he has given all that he has. He's going to inherit the estate. Now my master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell. But you shall go to my father's house and to my kindred. So there'd be this ethnic compatibility. And take a wife for my son. And I said to my master, well, perhaps the woman will not follow me. He said to me, the Lord before whom I walk will send his angel with you and prosper your way. And you shall take a wife for my son from my kindred and from my father's house. The plan's going to go forward. Whether the first woman God leads to you says yes or not, the plan is going to succeed. You will be clear from this oath when you arrive among my kindred. For if they will not give you to her, then you will be released from my oath. Plan B would have happened. Plan C would have happened. And this day I came to the well and said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, if you will now prosper the way in which I go, behold, I stand by the well of water, and it shall come to pass that when the virgin comes out to draw water, and I say to her, please give me a little water from your pitcher to drink, and she says to me, drink, and I will draw from your camels also, for your camels also, let her be the woman whom the Eternal has appointed for my master's son. Point out the one that's going to have the first chance to be a part of the fulfillment of this plan. But before I had finished speaking in my heart, there was Rebekah. Again, God engineers this down to the second. Coming out with her pitcher on her shoulder, and she went down to the well and drew water, and I said to her, please let me drink. The original Hebrew, please, can I have a sip? Please, can I just have a sip? And what she says, you can have all you want. You can have a long drink. She made haste and her pitcher down from her shoulder and said, drink, take all you want. And I will give your camels a drink also. So I drank, and she gave the camels a drink also. Then I asked her and said, whose daughter are you? And she said, the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah, that's the mother, bore to him. So I put the nose ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrists. And I bowed my head and worshipped the Eternal and blessed the Eternal God of my master Abraham, who had led me in the way of truth to take the daughter of my master's brother for his son. God's done his part. Will she do her part? Will she cooperate? Verse 49. Now, if you will deal kindly and truly with my master, Abraham, tell me, and if not, tell me, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left hand. Maybe the left hand's plan B. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Eternal. Now, even though Laban's mind is whirring, you can almost hear the whirring in his brain of, how are we going to make an extra buck out of this deal, if possible? Even so, how is Laban going to deny that Abraham's God is involved? I mean, even Laban has, this is clearly a series of miracles. How are we going to fight that? So let's give him credit for that. That's basically what he's saying. How am I supposed to oppose that? There's clearly miracles involved. The thing comes from the Eternal. I mean, who can deny that? We can't speak to you either bad or good. Here's Rebekah before you. Take her and go. They still haven't asked her. That has to come. That comes later. But as far as the family blessing, now the family blessing. And in that culture, oftentimes it was the oldest brother who was responsible for maintaining the honor of sisters, including being involved in giving permission to whom they would marry. Again, I think Nahor's in the background here. He's still alive. But Laban's doing all the talking and the negotiating and the giving of the family blessing. Let her be your master's son. As far as we're concerned, yes. So verse 52. And it came to pass, when Abraham's servant heard their words, that he worshipped the Eternal, bowing himself to the earth. Again, God, thank you. You are doing what you do. Then the servant brought out jewelry of silver, jewelry of gold, clothing, gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother. Yeah, that's kind of what he was hoping. And to her mother. And he and the men who were with him ate and drank and stayed all night. Then they said in the morning, they arose in the morning, and he said, send me away to my master. Mission accomplished, almost. We want to go now. Laban is always wanting to delay things, draw them out. Much later, he draws out for 7 years. Jacob's being able to go back to his home for the being able to marry his two daughters. So we see that here early on. No, let's don't rush into this. But her brother and her mother said, let the young woman stay with us a few days, at least 10. Maybe there'll even be a bigger dowry. Maybe you haven't unloaded all the goodies off of those 10 camels. After that, she can go. Verse 56, he said to him, do not hinder me. Since the Eternal has prospered my way, send me away so that I may go to my master. And they said, we'll call the young woman and ask her. Well, it's about time, wouldn't you say? To end this contingency. Is she going to do it or not? She could have said no. Let's ask her personally. They called Rebekah. If you're a young woman, somebody knocks at your door. You're still living in your father's house. Maybe you even haven't dated widely yet. Somebody you've never seen, and a whole bunch of somebodies you've never seen, say, we're going to take you back on a 20-day trip to marry somebody you've never heard of. I mean, that took a certain amount of fill-in-the-blank courage, faith on her part. Well, God, I think God put it into her mind. This was a calling, really. And she responds. So they said, we'll call the young woman and ask her personally. And then they called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? Very simply, I will. I will go. So they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men. So at least one of her companions. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, This is completely consistent with other promises that God had given already to Abraham. So this is almost like God inspired them to say these words. Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands of ten thousands, tens of millions. And may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. And though that's a prophecy, it would seem that God just put that into these people's minds, who were primarily idolaters, it was time for these words to be spoken. And they were spoken. I suppose if they hadn't, the stones could have cried out. Then Rebekah and her maids arose, and they rode on the camels and followed the man. And her maids, there it's the plural, so there's at least two companions going back with her. And they rode on the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now, 20 days later, the scene changes. Now it's back where Isaac lives, nearby to his father Abraham. Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening, and he lifted his eyes and looked, and there the camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel, for she had said to the servants, who's that? Neither one of them have ever laid eyes on each other before. This is an arranged marriage with God in the process. They said, well, that's my master. That's who you're going to marry. That's who you've come here to marry. So she took a veil, I guess a sign of modesty, and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. And then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife. Just quite simply, and he loved her. From what we can see, they had a good marriage. Not perfect, but a good marriage. He loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. This isn't that long after Sarah had died, and he was still apparently in the process of mourning the loss of his mother. But now he has a bride, one that God has chosen and given to him through Abraham his father, and the promises continue to be fulfilled. So yes, in this case, the person, the human being, who was given an opportunity, a calling to be a part of God's working out of his purpose, said yes. Then finally we come to chapter 25. And again, just a few introductory comments, and then we'll go through it. It's not that long of a chapter. We come to the end of Abraham's life now, in the flesh anyway. We're going to see him again. We see, as before, that there were some things in his life that were less than perfect. We've seen that throughout. There was an awful lot of good. God called Abraham his friend. And he is definitely going to be in the first resurrection. There's no question about that. But again, we see a couple of things that were not perhaps perfect. One is this keturah. Now, there's a little bit of obscurity about the timing. Here it says in verse 1, Abraham took again a wife, and her name was Keturah. Well, right on the heels of chapter 23 and chapter 24, at first glance, that would seem like Sarah dies, and he takes Keturah as his wife. He waits until Sarah is dead, and he takes Keturah as his wife. That may be true, but it may not be true. Hebrew scholars tell us that could also be translated. Instead of Abraham again took a wife, it could also be translated had taken at some previous time, conceivably even when Sarah was still alive. We see a lot of children that Keturah bore to Abraham, and it might be more easy to believe that these were born over a longer period of time, even extending back into when Sarah was still alive. We knew he took Hagar to be his concubine or second wife when Sarah was still alive, and she was a part of that decision. But she's called his wife here, but just like Hagar, maybe on one occasion was called his wife, she's also called his concubine. That's in 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 32, if you want to make a note of that. This Keturah is clearly called his concubine, not his wife, or not his first wife, never having the stature of Sarah. That's 1 Chronicles 1, verse 32. Keturah is called Abraham's concubine. Let me just quote what one man said. I think it sums it up about as well as you could. We've seen other things about Abraham's life that were less than perfect, certainly by the standards of Christ. This may well be another one. This one man put it this way: God records marital irregularities that he never approved. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't God's initial intent that a man have a wife and multiple concubines. That was never God's initial intent. It's like when the Pharisees came to Jesus about divorce. They said, well, Moses let us have divorces. What did Jesus say? Yeah, but from the beginning it wasn't so. That wasn't God's original intent. It was because of the hardness of your own hearts and your sins. And you've proved over many years you weren't going to do it God's way. So God regulated divorce through Moses. But the New Testament or the New Covenant standard is to go back to original intent. And I believe that's the same thing that we would understand. When it talks about the qualifications of an elder, the husband of one wife. So, I mean, that's just what it is. God records marital irregularities that he never approved. Now, he didn't reject Abraham for this. The fact that Keturah, as I mentioned, is first stated or talked about here does not necessarily mean, it could, but it doesn't necessarily mean he only married her after Sarah died, especially when we know that in 1 Chronicles she's called his concubine. Whatever it is, she bore him a number of sons, and they gave rise to different tribal groups, some of whom later became bitter enemies of Israel, Midianites and some of those that are mentioned there. Some of that isn't critically important to us. Let's pick it up in verse 6. All of that having been said, even to the end of his life, what was foremost in Abraham's mind was God's plan. And the plan was that there would be a chosen seed. It would be Isaac. And then it would be the one of Isaac's sons that God chose. It turns out that was Jacob. And then it would be the ones that he chose, and that would be the 12 sons of Jacob. And then it would be one of those that would be Judah, that would be the progenitor of Jesus. And this was always in Abraham's mind, this working out of this plan through God's selection. So we pick it up here in verse 6, and with that in mind, even though he had all these other sons through Keturah, he basically sent them away. Now that Isaac has a wife, he wanted to get them away from Isaac's presence so they wouldn't either, A, kill him to try to get all the inheritance or bother him. He wanted Isaac and Rebekah to have some peace. So Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had. And while concubines, the first one was Hagar. We've already seen him send away Ishmael much earlier, and now Keturah and these sons, he sends them away. He gives them gifts, helps them get started in their lives, and he sends them away from Isaac's presence. Eastward, away from Isaac, his son. Well, they're all sons, yes, but this is the special son. This is the seed son to the country of the east. All right, now verse 7. This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age. An old man, full of years, he was gathered to his people. This is interesting. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael shows up for the funeral. Well, that could have been awkward, except I think God can control people. And he wasn't going to let Ishmael come back and give Isaac a bad time. He came back to honor his father Abraham, Ishmael did, and it was peaceful. And you can see God's hand in that. But his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah. That's the same cave where Sarah had been buried, which is before Mamre. It's the only real estate Abraham ever owned in the Promised Land. This is the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried and Sarah, his wife, and later Isaac and Rebekah, and later Jacob and Leah. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac. God is still fulfilling his plan. This is the next step of it, Isaac's life. And Isaac dwelt at Beer Laharoi. All right, now verse 12. For a while there, we don't need to spend all the time in the genealogies down through Ishmael. That's not crucial to the story. I mean, it's not unimportant. But what's really more important is verse 19, the genealogy of Isaac, because we get back to the main thread. The promised seed that would lead to Christ. This is a genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife. And we just went through a whole long chapter as to how that happened. The daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, of Padanaram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded. Why is he pleading? Isn't it going to be now all downhill and everything's easy? Well, the whole theme of this 8-sermon series is chip off the old block. We learn that patterns that were started in Abraham's life, we can expect to see them in those who would be the chips off the old block. And Abraham had a lot of waiting. God gave a lot of promises, but one of the chief functions of building character or ways of building character is to wait patiently on God. Abraham had a lot of waiting to do. Should we be surprised that Isaac has some waiting to do? Isaac knows he has to have at least one son for these promises of God to be fulfilled. 20 years go by, no children. Very similar to what Abraham and Sarah experienced. So the patterns that were established in God's work in Abraham's life, we see in the first chip off the old block, Isaac. And I think down through history, including in your life and in my life. There's waiting. There's developing patience. There's trusting God despite any other consideration. Well, anyway, he has to wait 20 years. And then he appeals to God. He pleads with God, verse 21, for his wife because she was barren. And when it's God's time, miracles happen. The Eternal granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Twins. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if all is well, why am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Eternal, and the Eternal said to her, not one, but two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. one people should be stronger than the other. Well, who's that going to be? Obviously, the older will be the stronger. The older will get the birthright. No, that's the fastball you're looking for. In this case, there's a curveball. It says the older will serve the younger. God takes the one you would not think, and he says, that's the seed line. Not Esau, Jacob. And in fact, that whole thought is quoted back in that same passage in Romans 9 where we were earlier. If you go back to Romans 9, verses 10 through 13, you'll see this very, what we just read, referred to. It goes like this, that the purpose of God, according to election, might stand. God chooses the instruments that he works out his plan. And it's not always according to human logic. It's election. God chooses the younger twin, not the older. So that was that the purpose of God according to election might stand, that we might learn in these patterns. Don't try to figure out God. God sometimes throws curveballs when you're looking for a fastball. And it was that way in the first chip off the old block, in Isaac's life. So it wasn't his oldest twin son, it was his youngest that was the seed line. So we read it. When days were fulfilled, verse 24, for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau, hairy. And afterward, his brother came out. That was Jacob. He wanted to be first. He tried to pass in the wrong lane at the last second. But there was something about his character. He wanted to be first. Well, God was going to make him first, but in an unexpected way. He thought the only way to be first was to be born first. Election says you can be first if God elects you to be first. Not according to what we might expect. All right, so his name was called Jacob, the supplanter. He was trying to supplant Esau from the womb. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. And the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. Rebekah loved Jacob. That's not a perfect family where each parent has a favorite, but it is what it is. Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. Now, we can say what we want about Jacob, but one thing about Jacob is he had an interest in the promises that God had first given to his grandfather Abraham and then to his father Isaac. He wanted that. Maybe his motives weren't always pure, but he did value them, and Esau didn't value them at all. He didn't value any of that at all, as we see here. What is even worth a bowl of soup? Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew. I'm weary. Esau was a sensuous man. It was the immediate things of the flesh that he was most concerned about. He didn't think long term. He thought right now, immediate fulfillment. Therefore, his name was called Edom, red. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright. That's what he wanted. He valued it. At least we can say this, he valued it. It was the thing God had promised. And he put a value on that. Esau didn't. Esau said, look, I'm about to die. You're not about to die. You're hungry. You have an appetite, but you're not about to die. Look, I'm about to die. So what profit shall this birthright be to me? Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. That's all the value he put on it. Immediate hunger satisfaction. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. He ate and drank, rose, went his way, and he despised the birthright, his birthright. We could go on, but we won't. That brings us to the end of the story of this wonderful man of God, Abraham, the father of the faithful. A couple of concluding thoughts. As we end our long examination of the life of Abraham, there's really a warning right here at the very end. I think it's a warning we should personalize. I should, you should. Not to be like Esau, in the sense not to despise or devalue our calling, our birthright. To value the things of God, the calling of God. Chips off the old block of Abraham value the promises God began through Abraham, leading to the kingdom of God, the greatest inheritance possible. So I hope we've all been strengthened and inspired by the story of God's work in the life of Abraham and Abraham's response to God's work.